We have among us Sri Hrishikesh Gopi as the next speaker for the AI webinar. Sri Hrishikesh Gopi is the Director of Strategy, Analytics and Cognitive with Messrs. Deloitte. He has over 20 years of experience in the field of data warehousing, data lake, enterprise data management and analytics, with cross-industry experience from life science to FMCG to banking and insurance. His career span, he has implemented 30 plus data warehousing and visualization projects and has strategized and implemented 8 data lake engagements, including 5 projects with AI/ML technology. Sri Gopi also has delivered data lake engagement on cloud platforms like AWS and Azure. In the recent past, the platform modernization at FMCG client has saved the total cost of ownership by 70% by redesigning the solution. For one of the largest life science companies of the world, he managed their data warehouse for 3 years. This data warehouse collected data for supply chain, finance, sales and marketing, and R&D function with sources ranging from JDE, SAP, ECC, Ariba, Siebel, and many other custom applications for R&D. At its peak, the DW hosted close to 10 TB of structured data and served end users with close to 500 plus dashboards. The project won the Best Data Warehouse Award from the Data Warehouse Institute. And I would request the speaker to kindly deliver his talk.
Just a quick audio check. Am I audible to everyone?
Yes, sir, you are.
Thank you.
I made you presenter. You can kindly, you may kindly share your presentation.
I am. And I hope now this is visible to everyone.
Yes.
Wonderful.
So you may click on hide. Hide in the tab. You may click on hide, sir. In your screen, there will be icons. Thank you, sir.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So, good afternoon, everyone. Actually, very humbled to be here and have an opportunity to present to something that I always wished in my life. I passed out in 2001 and in engineering, and I am from a hometown called Aurangabad. Those who are from Maharashtra would know what where it is. And there's a specific institute called SPI, Services Preparatory Institute. After 10th standard, it was my dream to actually go to SPI. Because of some flat foot and all that, I could not get selected. Neither I could go to NDA. So it is my true pleasure and honor to actually talk to you guys, because it's one thing that I could not do in my life is to become a defense officer. So it is very glad an opportunity for me. I'm very glad that I'm able to share my experience that I have learned in commercial world with people who are doing the greatest and the best job in the world. So with that, let's get to the topic of today. It's 12:30 exactly, and I know that we have been always on time. This talk will go on for approximately 50 minutes, and we'll have 10 minutes of Q&A. What I intend to achieve here is, so I was present for Mr. Mukesh's session as well as Dr. Shiv Ramakrishnan's session. I think amazing speakers, very good examples. And I think now I have a sense of why I was asked by your team, Lieutenant Commander Ravi, to focus more on the tools and technology. So in this topic, we will talk about more on the tools and technologies of AI. But again, like every other speaker, I will take few minutes to still get us to that topic and then explain the tools and technologies associated to AI, and specifically the engine behind this, which is big data that needs to be explained very clearly to all the audience. So when I conducted such seminars in the past with my clients, I have put up this slide, which is pretty non-intelligent at this point, because I have seen at least the last two sessions, and I know that you guys have passed through this point. So you have a very, very good and great understanding, for that matter, of artificial intelligence. But to a typical layman, it is usually about image recognition and video processing and so on and so forth. It is more than that, and I think now you guys have an appreciation of it. This slide I had put together, you know, not knowing how the seminars are going to flow, but just to call out that a typical image recognition, you know, you in an AI term, we first just want to identify if something is a bird or a cat, and then we go one level deeper and understand truly what do they mean. So if it's a cat, is it an Egyptian cat or a Persian cat? So sort of enhancing the intelligence. What AI should do in our regular life is the senses that we have, which is a smelling, I mean, the five senses that God has gifted us, we should use AI to enhance those senses. And that's actually the ultimate goal of AI. I'll move on to my next slide now, because this slide is taken care. It's more than object recognition and image recognition, as I said, right? So this 50 minutes are going to be a lot about talks and stories that I have for you. On this slide, I'm going to explain you stories which are available even in the general domain. And then there are specific projects that I have done, architectures that I have implemented. And I'll bring those architectures and tools and technologies experience on my next slide. AI is more than image and object recognition. It is about pattern recognition, detection, foresight, radical personalization, many, many things, right? Now let's look at the left hand side, which is problem classes that AI solves, and then the right hand side. So in some sense, Mr. Mukesh has explained us the left hand side, which is the AI problem classes, and some of it has been explained in the very last lecture as to how do you solve it. So this slide, let me explain some stories which will help you to relate this better to both the earlier two talks that we had. Asian Paints, this is available on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and look out for, you know, success of Asian Paint or something like that, you will get a video by this, you know, investor. I forget his name. This is some you know, Bengali gentleman, a very famous investor, hedge fund investor in India. What you should know is Asian Paint has about 45% of the market share. And this example relates to real-time operations and process optimization. Asian Paint is a unique company which delivers to its dealer. Asian Paint does not have a network. They don't have like wholesalers, and they don't have distributors. They just have dealers directly. From their Ankaleshwar plant, three times a day, they can do a shipment to someone who is in remote location. Let's take not necessarily remote, but a difficult location. What that YouTube video explains is why Asian Paint has been so successful. Why have they captured 55% market share? And why are they so profitable? They've doubled the size of their company every 3 years. The reason was simple. They collected data for last, they have been collecting data since 1960s. If I have to go by that video, it claimed that the first supercomputer was actually bought by the owner of Asian Paints, Mr. Choksi, in 1960s, and he started collecting the data then. And using that power of data, today they know that I am right now in Thane. Someone who is beside me in Kalwa, which is a very, very shoddish, not to characterize it that way, but a shoddy suburb of Mumbai. There, the dealer who is sitting throughout the day has no clue what is going to get sold. But Asian Paint knows what is going to get sold in the next 3 hours on his shop. And this is an amazing example for me, because they know what is going to get sold in his shop. They can exactly every 3 hours send them a delivery, send an individual and delivery saying, stock this up on your shelves. You are going to be able to sell 5 liters of a particular type of paint in the next 3 hours. Then you are going to be able to sell 3 boxes of 2 liters of paint on a particular color in the next 3 hours. And this happens with a 98% accuracy as of today. This is a application, what the earlier speaker, Mr. Shivaram, was explaining us, saying you can use data from the past with various dimensions that they have understood to be able to predict what is going to happen in the future. So they have figured that piece out. A very real-time example from a business that we use. Because the pattern detection and foresight example was given, I thought I'll pick this one. Where Ankaleshwar factory produces exactly what is needed on an everyday basis to all the dealers and has a network to flush it into their stocks every 3 hours. This is the level of sophistication you can get to when it comes to real-time operations and process analysis. And you can imagine our Indian infrastructure roads are not easy, but even that has got figured out in their algorithm. And this is the beauty of using data from the past and accurately predicting it. There are three things that we learned from our last section. I think I like to call it out to you guys. And that's associated to this right-hand side of this slide, which is AI algorithms and the technical approach. One, there needs to be a program. And then now you and I can discuss that. Look, like, I mean, and I'm not a doctorate or something. I've used some of these ready-made algorithms, ready-made machine learning programs, and I've applied them in my real life to achieve the results. But I have not created those programs. A regular programmer like me, I can humbly accept the fact that if I were to ask to design this automated car, I'm simply going to ask the owner of the company, hey, tell me what are the rules you want me to record into, right? Example, if you see a red light, stop the car. A simple rule, I can code it. If the distance between your car and the next car is less than 2 meters, put the brakes on. Simple rule, and I can apply. But it is not sufficient to apply these rules only to complicated problems. And that is where what we learned from the last session is very important. That can you write programs which can teach themselves? And two examples that we got from our last lecture, one was a very simple linear, you know, W converging to X and Y. And then second was the differentiation, you know, the neural network example that we got. Those are the type of algorithms we need to write. So there is a regular programmer, guys, and then there is this AI programmer. Someone asked a question, why is it so tricky? It is tricky because it is very difficult to write a program which learns by itself. Not easy to determine, and the right input will get you to the, you know, global optimal. Sometimes it can only get you to the local optimal, which is why those programs are difficult to write. So one is a regular program, second is this ability to write a program which learns by itself. And in that process, what you would have observed from our last lecture is there is a good amount of statistical knowledge, mathematical knowledge that you require. Because think of the example from the earlier slide that I had, where there was a Persian cat and there was an Egyptian cat. Cat is a cat. It will take a while for my five-year-old daughter. She can't, honestly, I don't think my five-year-old daughter can differentiate between an Egyptian and a Persian cat. But my 10-year-old daughter might be able to. Why that? Because she can determine and recognize the pattern between those two. Now, in her head, some sense, she's doing that probabilistic mapping. She's drawing that line that we saw that was there between pluses and minuses that was getting intuitively drawn. And that, to a mathematician, to the program, there are two possibilities. One possibility is higher than the other, and that is why it has chosen that as an outcome. And that is that third thing which is critical in this entire gamut of, you know, building blocks of AI, which is machine learning, is this good understanding of mathematics and statistics to be able to draw it. I think we learned that from, I just wanted to recap because he explained it in a very lucid and a very nice manner. But trust me, that's the part which is, you know, restricting it not. In here, there are so many factors, not even 1% of them can write a meaningful machine learning or deep learning algorithm. And the reason for that is because it requires you to write a program which learns itself and have a significant amount of mathematical knowledge. Now, someone who is a doctorate will never realize it, but trust me, I also passed out 20 years back. My memory can't drop to a differential calculation. Definitely, probably single dimension, yes, but definitely not multidimensional, the way he was explaining. So AI is a larger gamut. The first step of is what we learned, which is machine learning, and an appreciation that those three things are very important: a regular program, a program that learns itself, and a statistics. And that is what makes AI so powerful. I'm sure this has been repeated probably a couple of times by now, but I'll just it is not today that we have invented it. As you've heard, people have been writing these theories and theses for long. It is getting democratized today. It is in the hands of people who are ordinary citizens of India like me. We can also think about having access to these tools and technologies today. So far in the past, such tools and technologies, due to the heavy investment, the nature of the computation storage required, were only available with people who are rich or with universities or companies who are super rich, right? So though, you know, we always are a little harsh towards ourselves, I believe history will judge us better. History will say that, you know, this era of 2010s and 2020s was also a golden era for AI, because AI is now touching the lives of individuals far deeper than ever it has been. Anyways, few important names: Alan Turing, who did all the big things for us, who wrote the first concept and said, you know what, I would like to have the machine to learn itself. And that has been the spark. That was the revolutionary thinking that has happened. And after that, people have started, you know, they have been on the journey of thinking how that can happen efficiently every day. In 2004, I think Google had published. So why is it easy today, right? And that's where I'm going to get into some bit of tools and technology. It's because you heard what, you know, the earlier two lectures that our ability to process the data is the number one reason why we have been able to come where we are, right, as of today. Just an appreciation of that fact. It is said that the computer which sent, the main computer which sent the man on moon, today I have got Apple 8, it has got about 6 times more power in terms of RAM as well as hardware. I've got a 64 GB and 2 GB, you know, simple iPhone. It has 5 times more power than what was used to send man on the moon. And that's the power that we carry in our pockets today. This is just an appreciation as to, you know, the words that was thrown at you, GPU, which is graphic processing unit, which is 10 times typically power than a CPU. Very deep, dirt chip, hard drives, dirt chip. And that is where this whole concept of big data and Hadoop has started. That, you know, the man who invented his Hadoop is the name of the, I think his name is Duncan. His son had an elephant which is called Hadoop. And he was just trying to understand, this is like a story, right? I mean, he has never vetted this out. But it is said that 2004, when Google published the MapReduce product paper, this gentleman was, you know, thinking as to how, he's a big time open source guy. He has contributed to Linux, he has contributed to MySQL. Those are the two basic things that everyone in the world uses nowadays. He was thinking, what can he do to make the processing of, you know, all the information that he has also democratized? What can he do to give it, make it easy for everyone to understand and everyone to be having the processing power? And that's where he created this, that's where the paper got published, and the story goes that he was thinking about it. He had read the paper. He got totally bought into using that as a technology, MapReduce as a technology, and he created this framework. And when he was having a discussion with his son, and his son asked, hey, dad, I mean, you know, he said, hey, your elephant cannot take so much of weight. How will it walk? And then he said, intuitively that kid of his actually drew upon another elephant from his you know, a toy box and said, well, I'm going to use my two elephants now to carry this way. And it just was so intuitive to him that, okay, that's what exactly the Google paper is saying. That's what even this kid is thinking. Why don't I actually create a framework? And he named the framework Hadoop. And then eventually it has been adopted by Apache now. And Apache has, it's an open source Hadoop product. Which is this concept that you can have multiple nodes working at the same time. They are in the technology language called nodes, to process the data parallelly. This was a big change that has happened in the industry, that cheap hardware now is used to process terabytes of data. In the past, trust me, it used to be, you know, without taking names, like Oracle or Teradata or some such companies, which will have a licensed product only, and you will have to pay a lot of money today if you want to process the information. Today, no more. Today, that's the big change. They are open source tools and technologies. You download them, you just buy the hardware. You're not paying for the software. And that has changed the regime from it being only available to people who are wealthy, rich organization, to common man like me, who can in his house have a small LAN of or WAN of four or five, sorry, LAN of four or five computers, and I can run the program simultaneously. Before specifically getting into toolset technology, again, a quick recap of what does this do for us, right? It does three things for us, and that's how we should view the entire world when it comes to solving this problem of AI through data, you know, data as the theme of this webinar goes, that how do you solve the problem with data? Data should give us three things. Data should tell me what has happened, which is the descriptive analysis. Data should tell me what will happen, which is the predictive analysis. And till this time, as you know, we have a fair level of maturity in every industry now, every segment, every customer. You will see, so distribution-wise, fairly speaking, 80% of the reports are still typically descriptive, because you still want to know what has happened, right? But approximately 20-25% of the reports nowadays are also focused on, tell me so what will happen tomorrow. And the last two examples, drawing again from our last lecture, is what will be, will this guy default in the loan? You're trying to predict. Will this, what will this opening price for a stock? You're trying to predict, depending upon what has happened. Your human intuition will get clubbed with that. And then there will be a third angle to the story, and this is where, what should I do? Can I take judgment based on, can I feel so confident about a prediction that I can start making, can I take some actions based on my prediction? And what should those actions be? And I'm going to come to some examples, real life examples that I have been part of for the projects and we have delivered to the client. And that will get you closer to what I'm, what these three layers will be. I will come back to this slide in a minute, but I just want to touch base upon these slides because there are two examples I want to pick from this slide. One is the predictive maintenance, and I think it has been talked a lot, but I'll put it to life through an example that we have done with a company which I can take name of, which usually I'm not allowed to, given Deloitte is an audit company. We are generally not expected to make name of our clients. However, for this one client, they have gone on YouTube. There is a video about Deloitte and Daimler, and you will see what, you will see all that I'm telling you. They are going to be talking about the same things there. We have done a predictive. How did we start with Daimler? So this is the very first one I'm going to take here. And then I'll take another example of, in an oil and gas company, how did we do the, large oil and gas company, which is based out of this very region that I am in. What did we do with respect to simply their, order or it was their procurement process. It's a very mundane process, right? But I'm going to tell you how we have been able to inject AI into the life of those people. Let's talk about this, let's talk about this example of predictive maintenance. Before we go to that predictive maintenance example, let's take a step back and think, how should this evolution happen with respect to our ability to churn the data, given where typically you are? If you are a regular company, obviously, with respect to you guys, this example is not the best one, but a regular company always starts saying that, look, I got something that I'm dealing with. I got a database, I got a data warehouse, I've collected some level of data, right? Should now they be suddenly jumping onto the data lake? We say don't do that, right? First, start using your Hadoop ecosystem to just store the data and process it as a means of cheaper data processing. Okay, so that you get warm up to this. The skill sets are different, so it takes time for people to understand that ground realities of life, right? Not everyone is good at this. So we first say, go with an architecture where you still have something on your data warehouse, which is your comfortable technology, and introduce new big data technologies to yourself, and then slowly move from there to shift the load from your data warehouse into the lake. So you will see that the first stage is warm and cold. Second, you start augmenting your BI reports or your intelligence or analytics with the data lake itself. Third is you fully integrate everything on the data lake. You have no more the old technologies in there. And fourth stage here is that your processes themselves are absolutely integrated through big data technologies into your day-to-day decision making. So let's take example here. When you book an Uber car, as it was explained again in the last section, that when you're doing the transaction, which was the credit card transaction, inherently the call went in for checking that it was a fraudulent transaction. Similarly, think of it, when you book an Uber car, there are so many decision points it has to go through, and it does all of it on the real-time basis. And this is where, but if you think of, you know, that's one example, and some of you I'm sure are using some level of softwares on your own, you know, day-to-day life, which are associated to your office. And we give this example all the time to every company that we go. You got SAP, right? Or you got Oracle. That is an ERP. Is that ERP intuitively telling you what you need to be doing? Not really. But somehow your Uber is telling you intuitively what you need to do. Why that? Because fundamentally the architectures were built differently. So the first architecture is more like, at best, in this evolution of architectures, the second one. Okay, it's not really the first one, it's the second one. It augments the BI at best, most of the ERPs that are in the world today. But from there, then there are companies which have started so, you know, I mean, in the last 4 or 5 years, they have built their entire architecture based on this concept of AI, machine learning, big data, and real-time decision. And hence they did not have a technical debt that they carry, that they had to retire before they were jumping onto the next set of things. And that is where the world will evolve. We predict that next 3 years, all these ERPs that you see, which are regular ERPs, will change their face and will have this real-time algorithm processing at the back end. So many things that are still done today, right? Like, I mean, there's so many things we do. We still raise a purchase order. We still map an invoice to the receipts. There are so many things that we do which can be automatically done, but they are not, because the inherent architecture behind never was meant to be doing like that. Now they will push themselves to do it. So that is the change which we anticipate in the ecosystem of AI and big data that will happen. Now I will take you to this example, which I was talking about the predictive maintenance, and explain you how that journey started and how did we land where we are today. So it was a simple problem. I think it was explained also both by both the speakers. Maintenance is a usual problem in any company. And again, I mean, I understand that there is a preventive maintenance that someone had that question in the last 2 hours. I saw that question. And probably you guys are right? The best way to attack anything is to prevent a failure to happen. So you should do a preventive maintenance. The question is, what is the frequency of preventive maintenance? Are you spent? How much is the man hours are going there? How much is the cost of preventive maintenance? Versus, can that be done in a cheaper way? Right? That is what I would probably look upon when we are thinking of preventive maintenance to be optimized further. But this particular company that I'm telling you, which is a Daimler truck. They had a very specific problem for us. They said, look, guys, the model, and maybe if we should spend 30 seconds on how Daimler, one of the ways Daimler take money. Daimler's Germany-based company, this is about the Germany headquartered company, but this project was done for Japan. We were in Japan to this project. One of the ways that they make money in Japan is that they rent their trucks to a lot of people who do shipping. And so it is on the rent. And there, the commitment that they have is, for example, it is supposed to be like a service. So let us say I am the shipment guy and I'm going to ship something from here to, you know, Delhi, from Mumbai to Delhi. I have a commitment from Daimler that their fleet will be available for me to use for this month. And within that 1 month, I have told him that I'm going to make 15 trips to and fro. And within that 15 trips, or rather in that, hence that's for a month. And in the first 3 years, I can't have the truck getting broken down more than twice. If that is the case, the minute it breaks down third time, that has to clear liability, because some important shipment, like it was a loss to shipment, the guy who was doing the shipment, he also, you know, had some effect of on his business, that look, your trucks are failing too much. It was just to, you know, put some service level agreements, put some sensitivity to, or you know, have some sensitivity to the providers, truck providers, that please be respectful of the fact that we are shipping something critical and your trucks are critical to that shipment. So your trucks need to be predictable, that they should not fail. This warranty cost was actually hitting the bottom line the worst. This was the problem they were facing. Obviously, what was the root cause? Trucks were failing on the road and they were unable to predict when the truck is going to fail. Again, a very regular problem that is there in many of the motor companies, automobile companies. The problem point is that this data gets, so what we did was, at this point, this problem has nothing to do with AI, but we'll come to the AI section. What we did was, we collected the aftermarket quality data. So we went back 3 years in the history and looked at all the failures that had happened when the truck was going in from point A to point B. Why was it fully reaching versus why was it not reaching? And when it was not reaching, what are the reasons that it did not? And which part failed? What was the notation made? I mean, what was the notes made by the service engineer on why did it fail? What were their observations? This was the project that we did. This was our pilot project to understand what is happening with Daimler trucks. Go in the market, understand, in addition to that, insurance data, which was helping us to understand, are there other people who are facing such problem? Are the insurance being invoked because of such problems? And then we share that data through a big data ecosystem. And I'm going to show you that architecture here. And then develop some advanced algorithms. We took regular, some of the algorithms you have heard already, special vector machines and live bias and whatnot. Long and short of it, we had then an ability to predict, instead of 17 months that it used to, you know, understand whether the, you know, earlier whatever they were using, their span of predicting something was as bad as 17 months. Okay, we have reduced that to literally three and a half months, which means we could predict that which are your trucks potentially going to fail for you in the next 3 months. Now, this is where they had the maximum amount of benefit, because it was in very real time, well, not really real time, but in a near term future. If you know some truck is going to fail this month, and you know that there is a pattern as to this is how it fails, and these are the parts typically that you have to replace, you would actively do that maintenance, right? This is what that proactive sensing was. This has helped them save approximately $8 million right in the first year. And this was the big success of that engagement. Again, where did this go? This went from an engagement where it was supposed to be a pure play, collect the data engagement. From there, it became what we heard from the very first session. A bit of a robotics was applied. I mean, not the human robotics, the software robotics, where, you know, we scan through all the documentation, we use some you know, OCR engines, optical characterization technologies, to convert what is scanned into a Japanese language. We use the translator from Google to convert that into an English to be able to store in a meaningful way. And then we further used algorithms to understand that if a part has failed, or sorry, a truck has failed, a truck has stopped, what were the reasons that it stopped according to the service engineer, what did he replace, and what are the comments that he did. In addition to that, what was the observation of driver before it failed? It was all collected. Obviously, data is important, data needs to be collected. It was all collected properly, and hence we were able to draw upon all of this data some meaningful conclusions as to what trucks are about to fail. I'll give you a very one interesting insight. Trucks with certain with engine power lesser than certain BHP at a altitude at a certain level were more prone to fail, which was a very and by the way, I think they used to fail more in the snow time. So imagine, this was not something that was getting captured anywhere other than the data that was getting captured. We some of there was this concept that we heard last time, right, that the IIT doctor told us that domain knowledge is important. This was one of the observation which was mentioned by a service engineer, that he has observed that some of the trucks or rather during the winter time, snow time, the trucks were failing. And then just a pattern that something which was on the higher altitude, people are having more failures. So it was that we added lot of environmental parameters to our analysis to see if the trucks had any effect on it. The clear correlation came out with altitude and snow beyond certain inches, which was resulting in failure. Right? And I found this was pretty fascinating for, you know, at least in 2015. And this we had done in 2015. It was very fascinating for us to see that in 2015, we were able to predict something like this. Now, where do we go from there, right? Now, if you Google for a Fuso truck, you will see that they're entirely IoT-enabled truck. After that, the client was so bought into what we had done. He had put sensors literally in pressure tires to understand the pressure, in his headlights, in the front of the bonnet, back of the bonnet, to understand what is happening with my car. There are about 800 odd sensors which have fit into the car. We collect the data, all of it, and we start real time now, not even a month out, right? Which is still a lot of month or 3 months out. It is still a lot of slack to connect, if you will. You are predicting that a truck will fail in the next 3 months. Practically, it is better than 17 months, but not really that good. You really need an ability to be able to predict something 2 or 3 days out, so that the servicing happens correctly, and you can do the best utilization of the asset. Where it lands today, my friends, is the driver who is driving it gets a notification on his dashboard that this truck needs to be now serviced in the next 100 kilometers. Just not that. Anywhere that route he is driving, that it has been clubbed with IoT, a signal is sent to the command center which looks for what drive he's on. On that road, whatever is the next service center, an appointment is booked depending upon the best predictable time that he's going to reach there. Appointment is booked that this truck is going to come to your place and has a potential of failure. Not just that, it gives the service engineer the history of what has happened with the truck along with the information why we are sending it your way, that it is certain there are these 6 parts that are going to be replaced by you, and please validate whether you need to replace these extra 4 parts or not. There is a deterministic thing that this has to be replaced, and a probabilistic thing this is left for the human to take a judgment call. And I think this is where the project turns from a pure play statistical algorithms into a whole world of IoT and AI, where the decisions are now being taken real time. Now the truck is launched, you guys can all see that video also. And I'm very proud of the fact that it was all started with, what we were trying to do with them. Having said that, why is someone asked the question, why AI technologies are difficult? The reality is that there are a lot of complex things in the background which are hidden from the end user. Right? Look at this diagram, which was the architecture that we had. Look at the ingestion layer here. There are so many, first of all, look at the data sources, right? There are so much of data that needs to be collected to be able to kind of get to this point of maturity. With each of the data, usually there are various ways and means that you can collect the data, and you have to be sensitive about what you use for the best and optimized way of ingesting your data into the big data ecosystem. Then there is a layer of data processing, which processes the data, churns it out, cleanses it. There was a question on data quality. Great question. Great. I mean, I will, don't quote me for what I'm saying. Just ask 90% of the regular data scientists on the road. They actually are doing data quality than data science. They are frustrated for it. Why? Because data quality is a big problem. And hence data processing layer, data storage layer, most of the time goes, 70% of the time in an advanced analytics engagement, AI engagement, actually goes in the bottom four boxes of this slide, which is data storage, data processing layer, and data ingestion layer. These are the ones which take maximum amount of time. Once the data is stored correctly, writing algorithms on it is a challenge, as we have heard from the last lecture also, but it is a challenge left for the last 30% of the world. And then there is a reason why you want to present something very beautifully and nicely. That's why you go with some of these presentation layers, right? Having said all of it, even on the right hand side, imagine that when all of this is happening, you're still worried about data security, data governance, the networks, you know, where is data going? Is that secured on cloud? Is that secured while you're transmitting? Is that secured at rest? Is your data standardized? Does it need enhancement? Is there a contextual matching that you're going to need? So you have to add more data. There's a whole gamut of master data management that you have to do to even use this data. So there was, or there is always, a very complex architecture behind most of these AI architectures, tools, and technologies, which we are, and I have drawn some of them here, which is why it is still supposed to be or will remain a specialized job for probably a decade or so. Because it's not at a point where a regular developer can just get up in the morning and start coding the bucket. Now, one that we have heard a lot right now with respect to, if I have to focus very critically on AI lens, I will say what you see here in the analytical layer and functional repository layer, which is something like a Cortana platform or SPSS. And then obviously everything famous in the world, the most famous tools and technology in the world for AI, you will hear, is always Python and R. Those are the ones which are the most widely used AI technologies, and obviously to write the regular programs other than, you know, Python or R, you use something like Java or C. Kind of, you know, what the doctor from the IIT was telling us, to the program has to self-learn. So there's someone has to write a while loop. That while loop is typically written somewhere, and the statistical models are all created in Python. So it is time check. Okay. So it is, you know, it is very impressive that something that looks easy has such a sophisticated architecture behind it. And that appreciation will help you also understand why it is still a niche skill to be able to get to this point. So this was my architecture of what I explained you earlier. I want to quickly switch back because the specific agenda of this one particular session is more about tools and technology. I thought it is wise to explore or put up a slide, or two slides I have put up. One which is a on-premise, the widely used distribution system for data processing is Cloudera. In all of these diagrams, you're going to see what you see as data sources, then the data ingestion framework, then data storage, and then eventually also an AI ML component. But I would like you guys to have an appreciation that AI ML component by itself is just one component of that entire story. To be able to use that effectively, you need the rest of the surrounding things equally good. If you just have a statistical algorithm but nothing to represent, if you don't have an application layer, it's of no use, right? What is it going to throw some output at? You need that. If you just have an algorithm but it doesn't know how to take a real-time data, which is going to come through an API, which is what you see here, which is a data API and subscription, no use. It needs to get data from sources using Kafka. Real-time streaming has to happen. Again, without that, no use, right? So the data is important, and to get to that point where you can use data is equally important, right? And behind all of this architecture, there has to be a very solid layer of data governance and operations. As to whom are you giving access to what type of data? because much of these data, at least to start with, necessarily is not de-identified. Our Aadhaar numbers are not. And I don't want anyone to know what my Aadhaar number is and what are the medical history associated to my Aadhaar number and financial history associated to my Aadhaar number is. So which means we will have to capture it, but still not make it available for everyone to be in the processing agent. So that governance and operations of how this entire thing happens is also a critical aspect. So this is a typical on-premise, various tools and technologies that you use. Cloudera is the most widely used on-premise architecture with respect to storage of data. If you go with that ecosystem, then you'll typically use MLLibs of Spark to go ahead. But more often than not, we still fall back upon Python and all when it comes to specifically writing the AI algorithms. To be able to store the data, we still use Hadoop, either a Hive or a HBase, which is, which are two different technologies to store the information and to process the data, just to actually, transform the data from one place to another place. We typically use Scoob or Hive. Right? Now, you would have also heard this quote there are three main cloud players in the market. There are multiple of them. Three ones which are famous are Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. I have just put a picture of Amazon here. Each of them have got literally by now at least a couple of hundreds, if not thousands, of services available for exactly these purposes, which is acquisition of data, storage of data, and again AI ML. So if you see here, again, with respect to start with, this AWS gives you a bunch of these options of how you can do AI ML. And this slide is a little bit outdated. There are today far more advanced, algorithms that AWS has floated. So I should, in fact, reminds me, I should update this slide a little bit. But anyways, they all have their own components that they have devised for us to take advantage. So one advantage that you can get by going on cloud is, let us say you can do your storage and ingestion somewhere else and use only the cloud component that you're required and pay for that. So pay per use concept that cloud thing has also changed processing and storage and converting, using the libraries dramatically in the world that I am in, which is the development world. So this is a picture of AWS. I have an equivalent picture of Microsoft and Google that I'm not going to go into. But again, key takeaway here is architecturally in data processing and AI ML world, let's take data processing. Data processing world, there are about 200 tools and technologies that I personally know of, and I have used at least 10 or 12 of them hands-on. Data storage world, I know approximately 20-25 odd different technologies for the storage purposes. Then there is this AI ML world, in which thankfully the competition is still lot. The famous ones still revolve around R, Python, and now with advent of Google, Amazon, and Microsoft, they are putting in their own Azure libraries and AWS, which are further intuitive. An R to make the life of a developer, right? So there are, you have now lot of options. The cap here, if I take you into one of the slides that I had, which is earlier here, catch here is the right hand side statement that I have first, which is any architecture that you will choose will anyway evolve. Any tools and technologies that you choose, rest assured, they are not future proof for 5 years. At best, they are going to be future proof for 2 years. So when you're choosing full-time technologies, one thing that you can be mindful about is to not get into vendor lock. Right? That way you can be flexible. If I write something in one language, is it transportable to the other language? And will it cost me different? If not, then choose that. That's kind of the guiding principle that we give to our client. Okay. I've got 10 more minutes here. I was on this slide. Naval application, I think a lot has been spoken on this topic by Mr. Mukesh. So I'm going to skip this slide. And I think now I'll summarize it in the interest of time, because 1:30 we should break. I'll have the last 10 minutes for Q&A. That the AI journey always starts with us decision that we need a good platform which needs the agility and which needs to store the data in a meaningful way. And that is what you see here, which is in the left hand side corner. That a data warehouse, a domain knowledge, an in-memory processing, the security associated with it, some components of cloud that we can meaningfully utilize, some way that we can represent data, and then going a step beyond it into big data and data lake. These are the basic building. In reality, keeping any one of them, and you try to do machine learning, you're not going to be successful. You try to do AI, you're not going to be successful. These are your table stakes. You get them right, you get the platform right, then you get modernize your data, you get the data right. Again, I'll hit back upon the question. They're so light. Data quality is so important. I can't tell you that. As I said, right, 70%, 90% of the data scientists today, unfortunately, in the commercial world, do a job of a data quality improvement person. That's what they do because of the bad quality of data. So bad that it's like you can't use it, you know, there's no use of that. Then only you will go to the exponentials, the upper cap of exponential being AI. And this is the task complexity. I think Mukesh touched upon it. I'll just quickly wrap it up. Robotics process, getting into intelligent automation. If you relate back to my Daimler example, that's what is happening. Getting into cognitive. And then, as I personally think, we got ourselves into a narrow AI category where we had only one use case, which was if something is going to fail, can you make certain calls and get an appointment booked and send a signal that I am coming your way, and these are the six things that you need to address for me when my truck lands at your door. A narrow AI application, right? That's where most of the general world, commercial world is, and they have not advanced beyond that. So thank you so much. I think this ends my presentation. I am happy to do any questions. I'll just minimize it and see if there are any questions that I have got here. Can I stop sharing at this point?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir, for enlightening the audience with your vast knowledge to the field of data analytics and artificial intelligence. May I ask the audience to raise their hands or type their questions for the speaker? We have one.
There are some questions. I think there are no questions. Everything was still 12:30 only. I assume it was for the last speaker.
So I'm getting questions on my mobile also from the audience who are sitting.
Sure.
So I have one question that, sir, how do we, there are some tools to transform unstructured data into the structured data for our applications.
Yes. Wonderful question. Let's understand what an unstructured information here means, right? Everyone has got, like, you know, AI has an elephant and everyone is trying to touch and tell you that what is what AI means. What is an unstructured data? Right now, we are having a communication. Should all of this be called an unstructured data, right? And should that then be converted into a structured information? Usually, the sense of unstructured data that is there out in the world is, if the data, the truly unstructured data in all reality today still cannot be transferred into the structure world. So what do people do? They still try to segregate that into boxes. For example, the Twitter feeds, the Facebook feeds, which are regular feeds that we feed into our clients' intel nowadays. You should know that in some sense that, see, Twitter is a 180 characters fixed thing. And there are some 8 elements associated to it. Who has tweeted? What time did he tweet? Blah, blah, blah. Right? I give an API call and store that into my table, which has got 8 columns. One of them is this 180 characters, which are complicated. So one is converting a structured, unstructured input like that into fixed columns. Second is then within that column, if you now go back to the earlier example that was given again by the doctor in the IIT, that can you use the natural language processing tools and technologies to be able to draw some meaning out of it? A typical meaning which is always drawn is this comment going to make you happy or unhappy? Is this a good comment which is to be interpreted as is a good feedback for me versus it is to be interpreted as a bad feedback for me? Are there any specific tools and technologies? Yes. You typically want to use something like a SCOOB or bunch of the connectors that IBM or Informatica sells in the market to be able to fetch this data. And then storage is your regular RDBMS. What are the tools as for assessing data quality of the data? Very interesting question. Look, the philosophical question you have to ask yourself is, how do you define the quality of data? I will give an example as to how did we define it in an oil and gas engagement, which was a North American client. They wanted to know what is the quality of their customer data. We did a very simple exercise. We said, where is your customer data stored? It was stored at 6 different places. And it had total about 150 attributes in total that they were storing for a customer. Something like name and address and address one, address primary address and corporate address and something like that. Then some sensitive information like credit limit, some sensitive information like ranking of the customer and so on and so forth, right? That internally they had devised. Then are there any legal cases going on against this guy, and then what are those legal cases, so on and so forth, right? So 150 odd attributes. You define first that for these 150 attributes, are they all contributing to your quality, or you are saying that no, only 50 of them will contribute to defining the quality? And then you also define further that of these three columns, if this column doesn't have the value that I need, this column can have only, for example, 6 values. For example, my address, my zip code needs to be always postal validated. If that is not postal validated, there is something wrong. My phone number needs to be 10 digit. And it cannot be 999999999. That is not allowed. Or 00000. There is a pattern. So what I do is, I first individually come to the rules of what should be there in the as a data quality for a particular column. And then I simply give weightage across all the columns and say, okay, for this, I've decided that my data quality is going to be dependent on only these 20 columns. These three columns carry 50% weight. These rest of the columns carry the rest of the 50% weight. And then do a profiling and come to a conclusion, for that matter, for every record, what's the quality? And we had did this project where there was a data quality dashboard for them, which will start at a high level, that overall your customer data quality is at 70%. And then you can click on it and actually get to a record by record data quality percentage. So this is one way to understand what the quality is. You had a question which is assessing, so I could answer that very clearly. If you were to enhance this question, and you had enhanced the last session saying, how do you improve it? Unfortunately, it's a governance matter. Not unfortunately, it is always a governance matter. You have to define owner of the data, call it from a data steward and data owner, and say, buddy, it is your responsibility to go and fix this data. Unless that happens, nothing should move in the project, because every result is a wrong result. Garbage in, garbage. So any other questions?
Thank you, sir. We at the Center of Excellence for Big Data at INS World are also working on designing and implementing a data warehouse. So we would like to get your guidance on this, that what are the challenges which are involved in designing and implementing a data lake or data warehouse?
Sure. A data warehouse typically lands itself into two important challenges. First is, it is the leg which will expose all the realities of life, because your reporting will happen out of database. So something that was inputted wrong in the source system will get reported in the data warehouse, and the quality will get exposed there. So number one problem that data warehouses exposes is data quality. And the reports render themselves not usable because of the data quality issue. So I to keep watch on, come what may, please beat the drums about data quality being good at the source while you are doing the development of the data warehouse. The second problem with the data warehouse is the performance. And this leads to how frequently can the data warehouse be loaded, how frequently data warehouse or data lake can be loaded, and how much real-time the reports or analytics can be generated for our end user. This choosing the right tools and technologies so that your end objective is met is important. The challenge is that end objectives keep changing. Again, have a vision for reasonable 2 years down the line and say, if this satisfies my next 2 years requirement with respect to data volume, with respect to the type of data I get into, etc., I am going to be satisfied with it. See, in the world of AI, they always say, right, there is no right answer. The answer is acceptable. Is this a reasonable risk to accept? Yes, then go ahead and take the risk. Is this a reasonable decision to take? Yes, then go ahead and take the risk, right? When I am sending the truck all the time, am I 100% right that truck is going to fail? I have not even allowed it to fail. But that's the best guess, right? And it's a reasonable guess. Same way, an architecture is a reasonable guess of an architect. He should not get hung up that he has to do it in the next 2 years or it needs to serve for the next 20 years. Next 2 years is a good horizon with the speed with which the technologies are changing. I think if you just accept these realities of fact matter, you will be able to embark on your data warehouse journey and meaningfully complete it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir, for enlightening the audience with your vast knowledge in the field of analytics and artificial intelligence. The topics covered during the session, such as journey of AI, evolution of analytics, AI application, AI BDA platform, and their implementation pattern, were very informative. The architecture, relevant tools, and available solutions for data analytics and machine learning were covered in a very effective manner. On behalf of Commodore Ajay Patni, Commanding Officer, INS Vulsora, I thank you for conducting this session for AI webinar. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. It was again my honor and pleasure. Please feel free to get in touch with me if you have any questions associated to analytics, big data, data lake, or AI. I'll be happy to help you.
Thank you, sir.